We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Queen Anne reigned over England, Scotland, and Ireland for 12 years, but not a great deal of attention, historical or otherwise, has been paid to her. Plagued by ill health throughout much of her life, Queen Anne had few significant matters of state accomplished during her time in power. Plus, what little that was written about her was not very flattering or objective.
The new film, The Favourite, is perhaps not the most flattering description of her either, but it certainly brings attention to her court. Directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, The Favourite shows the behind-the-scenes politics and power plays between Queen Anne, Lady Sarah Churchill, and Sarah's cousin, Abigail Hill.
The Favourite has already secured over a dozen nominations for the Critics' Choice Awards, and the momentum will likely continue into the Oscar season.
Film contributor Dave Larson joined Audrey Nowakowski in the studio and says that if you're a fan of great filmmaking or are curious about the role of women in history, this film may be right for you.
Queen Anne gave her name to a gracefully curved style of furniture. Her 12-year reign has otherwise been little remembered. Although the 18th-century monarch left only a slight legacy, The Favourite finds great interest in her story. In the latest film by provocateur Yorgos Lanthimos, Anne is at the center of vicious courtly and sexual intrigue, only some of it provoked by men. Anne governs Great Britain largely on the advice of two women, first from Sarah Churchill and then from Abigail Hill.
The Favourite follows Queen Anne, played by Olivia Colman, Lady Sarah by Rachel Weisz, and Abigail by Emma Stone. Typically, you think of Restoration-era films as lofty, serious things, but what were your first impressions of The Favourite?
Well, I guess, first of all, if films had existed back then, they wouldn't have been quite so lofty. The Restoration theater, if that's a model here, was often very bawdy and very provocative, so I think that if the director had that in mind, I mean, he certainly succeeded in putting that across. It's a beautiful movie to look at. It really contrasts the lives of people at the top versus lives of people at the bottom visually. The poorer people and the servants are always cramped together in claustrophobic, dirty settings, whereas the rich have these enormous gilded caverns practically that they're living in, gliding across the polished floors. The other thing, I mean, history is not an easy subject because there are, you know, some people think, well, here's the fact. I mean, this is what happened. Well, but what does it mean? I mean, Queen Anne is kind of a figure who was often overlooked by historians. I glanced at the Cambridge History of Britain, pulled off my shelf and looked at it for the period of her reign, and it's mentioned in a couple of scattered references. Because she didn't accomplish anything of great geopolitical importance. What we know about her is partly written by a woman who turned on her, Sarah Churchill, who did a memoir that kind of attacked her. Winston Churchill, Sarah's descendant, wrote at some length about Queen Anne in that period of time. Many conventional historians kind of ignored her, but there's a greater interest in women's history now. So people are looking at the information that's out there, finding new things perhaps because they're looking for these new things. I think that one thing that I would criticize the movie for, perhaps, I'm no expert on early 18th century England, but some historians would say that Queen Anne is made to look more foolish in the film than she may have been in real life. In the film, she looks like a very uncertain, foolish, just not engaged, not well-informed person, easily manipulated. And some people would interpret what happened then and say, no, she really was much more hands-on than the movie would have us believe.
Right. It's alluded to in the film, but doesn't center around it. But Queen Anne suffered through 17 ill-fated pregnancies. She had severe illness, including gout, probably some mental illness as well, which, as you mentioned, you know, may or may not add to the characterization of her and some of the comedy that is played off of her instability. But when it comes down to it, Queen Anne is played by Olivia Colman, and this is deemed as her breakout role of the year with this film. What did you think of her performance?
Well, I think it was a masterful performance, and mistressful. I don't know if there's a word like that to feminize it, but yeah, masterful performance. She even looks a little bit like portraits of Queen Anne that one can find. Again, you know, is this exactly the way Queen Anne really was? I mean, we don't really know for sure. It certainly is a plausible enough interpretation, but the acting from all the three principal women in the movie is superb. I think that they all, you know, deserve some consideration for nominations and maybe even victory, depending on who they're contending with.
Yeah, Rachel Weisz has had a very strong year, and right before this, she also had the film Disobedience. And I think Emma Stone pleasantly surprised a lot of people with her role in this.
Yeah. Well, you look at, I refer to it as the masterpiece theater genre, because there always has to be something like this released during Oscar nomination period of time. This is like the quirkier fringe of the masterpiece theater genre, definitely, but it fulfills many of the expectations: opulence, period costumes, great acting by at least a partially British cast. So, yeah, I mean, I found it to be a very enjoyable and thought-provoking film at the same time. It's really a film about power relations, the relationship of power. And nobody in this film comes across as being a particularly nice person. You know, not the primary women in the film, and certainly not the men who, you know, there was one scene where Harley, actually the Earl of Oxford, who was the head of, you could say the anti-war movement of that era. He opposed this senseless war that Britain had gotten itself into. So we might think that he was the better of the several male characters, but he thought of nothing of just slapping Abigail into a ditch just to prove who's boss here.
Exactly.
I have lordly authority over you. And Abigail, and for her part, behaves no better once she gets authority over other people.
Yeah, the power play and the juxtaposition of period, you know, authenticity in regards to the setting and the costuming and the dramatics with the occasional shove in a ditch or vulgarity, perhaps maybe not so accurate language that would be depicted in other films.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this somebody I'm sure has written about, you know, forbidden language of the Restoration period. What words did they actually use? And maybe they did use some of the words which we can't use on air here right now.
Right.
Because they do have very old origins. So it's very possible that our bad words have not changed too much over the centuries.
That's true. It's a fun, not just power play, but a fun kind of juxtaposition or a fun little attention grab for the audience to kind of bring you back to the absurdity of what's happening.
Right. And I guess that Merchant Ivory wouldn't have done it quite this way.
Right. So do you agree with this classification of this movie being a comedy?
No.
What would you call it?
It's a satire, certainly, a satire of a particular time and place, a satire of power relations between people, which has applicability to us today. I mean, really, you know, in some ways I kept thinking that, yes, the form has changed, but human nature in some ways has not. We at least until recently, have lived in a society where there were more curbs against egregious displays of behavior like this. It seems that we're slipping backward towards something more like that period of time.
Yes, and this film was surprising in my experience because director Yorgos Lanthimos, his previous films, The Lobster, and in particular The Killing of a Sacred Deer, were like odd, extreme philosophy classes. Very dark, very disturbing at some points. And compared with these, you know, The Favorite is a much more subdued and perhaps more general audience friendly, but it's not without its, thought-provoking scenarios, but it's not as much of a moral philosophy course.
Well, I think it's easier to get into it as simply a very interesting and beautiful film than his previous films. This time he was working with an outside person as a screenwriter, a woman who took interest in the subject of Queen Anne and wrote a screenplay, I guess on spec more or less, and somehow it came to Yorgos's attention. Normally, he had been working with a friend of his, I think, or a frequent collaborator. So he is getting outside input into his whole little milieu. And I think it benefits him as a filmmaker as well to kind of like step outside of his normal preoccupations. But yet at the same time, again, you could say there is a kind of a philosophical dimension to this film, too. It's not light entertainment, though it is very entertaining.
Right. And he's noted as saying that for this film, and especially with the three leading women, that he didn't want a victim or a villain. And I think that shows both in the actions of the characters, but also in the writing and the setup. It's written, as you mentioned, by Deborah Davis and Tony McNamara. So do you think that the screenplay is ultimately the strongest thing that everything else could build off of?
Well, it's a very strong screenplay. I would turn his statement upside down and say that everyone is a villain in this movie in some way, and everyone is a victim. I mean, again, there aren't heroes and foes in this movie exactly, because everybody is sort of tainted by the bad norms and expectations of that time and place.
Now, with the depiction of the Restoration era, I would argue that this is worth seeing in the theaters just because of the grand locations and sweeping cinematography of it. And with the cinematography, there's also some wide-angle distortions and fisheye lenses used pretty frequently in here, which at first threw me off. But then, you know, I grew to enjoy, you know, these pleasant visual surprises. What was your impression of that? Did it benefit the story overall?
I think it is not only visually interesting, but it probably, I'm going to make a guess here, that film critics like to make guesses like this. It shows the, or suggests the distorted nature of that society and the lives of the people living in these splendid palaces, but everything is a little warped in certain scenes. And also camera angles, some of them are very interesting and non-conventional. You're kind of seeing things in an askew kind of angle. And to me, I walked away with the idea that, yeah, this was a warped situation, and therefore the camera lens, you know, is conveying this.
Mm-hmm. And with the scene at the end, we have a bunch of filtered images over one another. So kind of going along the animal theme for this director, you know, first he has a lobster, some racing lobsters make an appearance in this film, then deer, and now
rabbits.
This is rabbits, mm-hmm. Full of rabbits. So what did you take from that? Was this his way of having some symbolism?
It's a motif. Well, I suppose Alfred Hitchcock had certain motifs, you know, important directors with a body of work that has consistency often have some visual thing or some kind of a thematic carry through from one film to another. So animals, I mean, I kind of felt that, you know, certainly there was cruelty to a particular rabbit toward the end of the film. You begin to wonder that the rabbits were being kind of neglected anyway toward the end as things were unraveling and falling apart. I would be very interested in reading a very lengthy analysis of Yorgos Lanthimos's work, what he actually has to say for himself. I mean, he's done interviews, but if somebody could kind of compile it into a book. And I think that by this point, he's interesting enough of a resume that it would be worth reading.
Definitely. And this film in particular has already gotten 14 Critics' Choice nominations. Do you think this momentum will carry into Oscar season?
Well, I think it would be hard for it not to at least get you know, set decoration or something.
Costume design.
I would hope it would get screenplay. I would hope that there would be actor, you know, actress nominations in this film. I mean, I suppose actress, really, the male actors are good, but their roles are not prominent enough, I don't think, to bear up to Oscar nomination levels. But certainly, you know, all three of the women are deserving of something.
In regards to what you've seen so far this year, where does this film rank for you personally?
Well, very near the top of the list, if not the top of the list. I was beginning to be a little depressed about the state of filmmaking in 2018, but I began to think back over it, and there were a number of good movies this year. I think what threw me was that there weren't very many being released in October and November. It was kind of a blank period of time for film releases. But now things are popping up. The Wife, for example, has been reissued to movie theaters. That came and went a little quickly last summer, but that's another, you know, woman-oriented film, which I think deserves some attention from the Motion Picture Academy.
Overall, The Favorite, encourage audiences to see?
Yeah. I mean, I guess if you are really squeamish, you know, maybe there are things you wouldn't want to go see it, possibly.
If you typically don't see rated R films.
Right. It's an R-rated film. Yeah. So it's definitely, it's an adult R-rated film. I mean, I would say in the true sense of what it means to be an adult. If you like great filmmaking, if you have any interest in the history of the period or the role of women in history, go check it out.
All right, Dave. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express and a regular Lake Effect film contributor. The Favorite is out in theaters now.